Hello, and welcome to Old Planet Young People. In this series of programs produced at radio station CHLS-FM in Lillooet, British Columbia, we are looking at environmental projects in the Lillooet area and interviewing some people involved. We're also talking with some young people working on these projects and asking them about their concerns for the future. The Fraser River is like no other river. There are so many people that rely on the river for work, play, and even their culture. You can go any way up and down the riverside and find people using the river. There's a group of people that go all the way up to the top of the mighty Fraser and just using a couple of rafts float their way down to where the river meets the ocean. The entire way learning about the river and all it has to offer. This group of people is called the Sustainable Living Leadership Program, or the SLLP. In this episode, I interview Amanda Ned and Lena Aziz from the SLLP group, and they take turns answering my questions. I met with them on a hot August day, just after their rafts had arrived in Lillooet. Many local residents had shown up to greet the SLLP travelers, who were busy making camp and preparing food, so you'll hear a lot of background activity. After them, Bonnie Dunn and Jessica Hopkins answer a few questions about the Fraser River and some of the struggles the salmon inside of it are facing. Here's Amanda and Lena.
Amanda Ned, 32. Well, the
headwaters. Has this trip made you more environmentally cautious? If so, can you give us one or two specific examples?
Oh, absolutely. This trip has been amazing. And at the beginning of the Fraser headwaters, we camp for 2 days, and in those 2 days there's 11 people camping, and we had not even a tenth of a garbage bag filled after the 2 days of camping, and it's amazing. After 4 days it wasn't even halfway filled. After a week we still barely had half a bag of garbage. Our compost was emptied maybe four times, but our garbage bag remained unfull. And the fact that we could do that, yeah, it's amazing.
My name is Lena Aziz, and I'm 29 years old.
Are there any specific environmental threats you're concerned about?
Climate change is definitely one of them, though anything that relates to salmon, so freshwater issues, are of huge concern to me. Yeah, so how we still tend to pollute our waters, and how not everywhere you don't have tertiary sewage systems everywhere. So a lot of stuff still gets pumped into the Fraser. So yeah, those are some things that do concern me.
If you have children or hope to have children one day, are you worried about the environmental problems they'll face?
I don't have children. I don't plan to have children, but I work in a school district, and I want to teach them about the Fraser River. That's what's come out of this. I want to teach the students about this amazing watershed that we live on. And that it doesn't just flow through our town, that it starts way up in Mount Robson. And there are 100 other communities that are affected by this water, not only us, but all the way down to, from up there all the way down to the ocean. And it's important that we all work together as a team to make sure that it still flows high and full of fish.
Has this trip inspired you to take new steps toward environmental protection in your own life and in your own community?
Definitely. The community that I'm from, so is the Sri Lankan community, they're not particularly aware of these things. And I'm kind of one of the only people I know in this community doing this sort of work. And this has inspired me. I think this is a story going down the Fraser that everyone can connect with at some level and will help me talk about my other passions, water, freshwater resources, agriculture, salmon, in a more, perhaps, easier to understand way.
What's the most amazing thing that you've seen happen so far on this trip?
My very first day, we were walking as a group to the Fraser River, and I saw a piece of garbage in front of me, and one of the other participants was going to walk towards it, and I thought, oh, she's not going to pick it up, so I started making my way to walk behind her so that I could pick it up, but lo and behold, she picked it up, and it shocked me that I thought she wasn't going to pick it up, when in reality, she's here for the same reason I am. And it was a real eye-opener knowing that I'm not the only one who is trying to make a bit of difference. And yeah, it was just a piece of garbage, but right away I knew that these people want to make differences in their own communities, just like me.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, Amanda.
Yeah, thanks.
That was Amanda Ned and Lena Aziz from the Sustainable Living Leadership Program, telling me about their trip down the river and just what they have learned. Now we're going to turn to someone who has spent her life working with the salmon in the Fraser River. Bonnie Dunn gives me a few minutes out of her busy day and tells me all about her current studies and the work she is doing and just what kind of problems the salmon are facing from a cultural aspect.
My name is Bonnie Adolf Dunn, and I am the project manager for Statlian Eco Resources.
How long have you been working with fish?
20 plus years.
What keeps your interest in this line of work?
I just love the whole process the salmon go through, their life stages. I find very interesting. And I find it very interesting, the cultural aspect with the Statlian people and their love of salmon and the culture of their fishing, stwan making.
Which fish is your highest concern right now?
That's a hard one. I have two, the Chinook and the Coho. The Chinook and the Bridge River system is obviously a really touch and go issue, and I'm glad the studies are going on so we can help to figure out what the best is for the Chinook in this bridge system. And just overall the Coho, because they are to be very scarcely seen within either system.
Being a project coordinator, there must be a few different studies you're in charge of. Can you tell me about the fish-related ones?
Well, there's a lot of them, actually, but I can think of two that are quite interesting. The Bridgemon 3, the Lower Bridge River Adult Salmon and Steelhead Enumeration, the primary focus is to evaluate the effects of different flow releases on juvenile and adult salmon productivity within the bridge system. And so that project is developing new and refining old approaches for adult estimation to provide escapement data.
What's a flow release?
Flow release is what Terry Zagge Dam releases. It could be 1999 and prior, there was zero water being released from Terry Zagge Dam. And then they went to a 3 CMS release and then to a 6 CMS release. And throughout those different releases, they've been doing studies to find out what's best for the adult and fry salmon.
What does that CM stand for?
Cubic meters per second. Bridgemon 13, it's obviously another great project managed by Statlium and employs a lot of Statlium technicians. It's called the Seton Sockeye Smolt Monitoring Program. And in the entrainment of sockeye smolts in the Seton Powerhouse is a long-standing fisheries problem since the Seton Dam was constructed in 1956. Most of the smolts will swim into the power canal, where the mortalities of 17% have been estimated. So they basically 17% of the smolts are being chewed up by the turbines. So various attempts had been made to mitigate the entrainment mortality, including the use of sound, strobe lights, louver lines, and following many years of testing, BC Hydro and the Statlium agreed to monitor the feasibility of operational modifications, meaning they have nightly shutdowns so that the smolts are protected as they're migrating out of the Seton system and down the Fraser out to the ocean. The annual smolt mortality target is defined now as 5%. So that's a really great project as well.
How important are fish to this community?
Well, culturally, they're hugely important. I've heard it said over the years by our Statlium elders that if there's no salmon, there's no Statlium. And it has been predicted for years and years by our elders that the salmon runs have depleted. I mean, just in the Bridge River system alone, there used to be a 400,000 Chinooks swimming up to Tyacks Creek and such. And since they built the Terry Zagge Dam, I mean, sometimes we've seen the lowest numbers of Chinook as, you know, 12 count, a visual count. So culturally, it's a huge importance to the Statlium people.
What are some of the problems is our community facing with salmon?
I think the biggest one would be water temperatures.
What is the temperature of the water have, and what effect does it have on the salmon?
Well, basically at 20 degrees Celsius, they're dying. They're unable to survive in that type of water temperature. But also, as they're migrating from the ocean up the Fraser River, you know, it's exhausting enough to go through places such as Hell's Gate and the BC Hydro systems and the effluents that are dumped in the Fraser. But overall, the water temperature, I think, is what's the biggest impact. The Stoutland people have always known when to fish and when not to fish. They know that if the first run is going by and the early steward are swimming by us, we know not to take those fish, that it's for our brothers and sisters at the headwaters of the Fraser River and Takla. And because the early stewards have become almost extinct, to be honest with you, it's we haven't fished them for over, I think, probably 40 years. They were the first salmon. They were the first salmon that everybody ate, but we haven't fished them for a long time so that our people that are in at the headwaters can have some salmon. But they're still declining. They're not improving.
What other kind of problems are you having?
I think, obviously, the mining spills are huge. There's going to be consequences there. Commercial fishing. Quite a few years back, Department of Fisheries and Oceans Canada opened up a commercial fishing within the Fraser itself. So currently, we may have 45,000 predicted Gates Creek sockeye coming up through the Seton system across the lake and into Gates Creek. But then you might see 20,000 of those being included in the Stolo commercial fishery. So yeah, I think there's a lot of problems. And the harder we work here in Lillooet to look after the Bridge Seton systems and our salmon that we consume, it just gets harder every year, with whether it be commercial fishing, water temperatures, lice. It's just ongoing. We just keep working harder, and we still are losing our numbers of salmon.
Lice? What do you mean?
Sea lice.
Sea lice?
Yeah, from fish farms. There's fish farms all over on the lower mainland, and it was supposed to be a provincial jurisdiction, and it became a federal. I'm not quite sure how all the politics went there, but they do assume at this point and that there's issues there. The Cohen Commission, I think it was handed down 3 years ago, the court decision, and not one single recommendation has been followed from the Cohen Commission court case, which is really down. It brings me down to think of that, you know, all that millions of dollars spent on that court case, and when it came right down to it, not one single recommendation was followed. It's been 3 years now, and they were basically given 1.5 years to have all of the recommendations followed, and not one of them have been met yet. Even within Lillooet, putting the new water system down on Seton River, that used to be prime Chinook rearing habitat, and now there's a water intake there.
What's a rearing habitat?
Well, it's where, say for instance, a Chinook will stay in the system for 1 plus or 2 years, I can't exactly remember, but they'll stay in a system before they'll smolt and migrate to the ocean. In all my years of electroshocking in that area on drawdowns, I'd always find Chinook there. 1 plus years old usually, and now there's a water intake there. And you know, I remember seeing that when it first started happening and contacting DFO and contacting the conservation officer. And at that time, they couldn't even believe it was going on and it had been permitted. But when they called their higher-ups, it was a good-to-go scenario.
After all your years working with fish, what's your most memorable moment with them?
I think complexing the lower channel was my memorable 6 months. Took us 6 months to complex. It took many years to get the funding for it. But it had been built because they lost the Chinook spawning grounds when they put the Seton Dam in. So at that time, the Pink and the Chinook spawning grounds were spawning at the hydro facilities. So they built the spawning channels, the upper and lower, just for them, I guess, for Pinks. And when the Pinks would spawn out, they'd wait till that spring. Pinks emerge from their egg sac and leave the system immediately to the ocean. And then they would close the spawning channel down for another 2 years till the pink came back, because pinks only come every odd year. But one year I decided I wasn't going to let it close anymore, and I wanted to keep it running all year long. And at that time, every year we'd see a few coho as well. So what we did, and we complexed it for coho. We worked with Ministry of Environment and complexed it for steelhead. We worked with DFO and the engineers department, and were able to complex it, making it some deep pools, some riffles and ponds. And my last year at Cayuse working there, I worked with Kim North with Split Rock Nursery, and she had wrote a proposal and for the Fraser River foreshore project. And that has been a success. I think she's been going on now for 7 or 8 years with the Split Rock Nursery and all the other things that have happened down there, the Ken Wright bird studies. And to see that the Lower Seton Spawning Channel is such a successful little ecosystem in itself, I guess that would be an overall the memorable moment.
All right. Well, thanks, Mom and Bear, for this interview here.
You're most welcome.
That was my mother, Bonnie Dunn, a woman who has spent her life studying and saving salmon. She used to spend her days in the field for her studies, but the work is hard on the body, and after so many years, has taken to project management for the Statlium Eco Resources, managing the Bridge Seton Water Use Plan. She has been mentoring a few environmental technicians over the years, but she's convinced Jessica Hopkins, who is young enough to climb over those slippery boulders and do all that young people stuff, to take on her previous work. So I went and found Jessica Hopkins, and she tells me what got her into this line of work and what keeps her in it, and just how hard it can be sometimes.
My name's Jessica Hopkins, and I'm a project supervisor and senior technician for Statlium Eco Resources, and I'm 27 years old.
When did you first realize you wanted to work with fish?
I think I was 17, and I was trying to figure out what I should do after high school, and I kind of looked, you know, within my own family, and, you know, the most successful people in my family worked in the environmental field, and so that made my choice fairly easy, and I applied to the Nicola Valley Institute of Technology.
How long did you go to school for this?
So I went to Nicola Valley for 2 years, getting my environmental or natural resource technician course, and then I transferred to Vancouver Island University doing fisheries and aquaculture. Unfortunately, there was a strike in the middle of my schooling, so that kind of got delayed a year, and what I ended up doing was starting my Bachelor's of Science in Computer Science.
What fish primarily do you study?
So I mainly study salmon species. Not just salmon species, but it's essentially all the elements that surround salmon populations. So their predators, their environment, stuff like that.
What salmon do you primarily study?
So I mainly study sockeye salmon. The reason being is that, I mean, obviously that's the one that people put the most importance on, but here in Lillooet, we study sockeye salmon because those particular populations are so heavily impacted by BC Hydro, and most of the contracts we have are with BC Hydro that was negotiated under the BC Hydro agreement with Statlium and BC Hydro. So because Statlium fine sockeye to be of such importance, that's why all the projects are geared towards sockeye.
What kind of impact does Hydro have on these sockeye salmon?
I mean, Hydro has an impact on these sockeye salmon from, you know, their juvenile stage all the way up to their adult phase. I mean, and on every step of the way, they impact them. Like, they've changed the lake system where these sockeye rear, and then they've made it even more difficult where they have a dam. Sockeye have to pass through there when they're going down the dam, which can result in mortalities. Also, they sometimes will go down to the powerhouse. And then the same way, when they come back upriver, they have to go right back through that dam and then bypass all the powerhouses.
How do you help the salmon get through the dam?
Well, we have, there's a fishway, and it does, but it doesn't help salmon get past the dam. I mean, part of our research has shown that you know, almost 50% of female sockeye that try to go through the dam actually die right after going over the dam. So that's part of the research that we've been doing.
What have you found in the research?
So what we found is that when sockeye salmon have to go through something like a fish passage, they have to do something called burst swimming. Burst swimming happens naturally when they're trying to go through, say, a place like Hell's Gate, right? Problem is, when you're going through a fish passage, you're doing burst swimming for a long period of time. And this burst swimming causes something called lactic acid to build up in their systems. This causes them to have a heart attack and die. And it's pretty damning, the evidence. It's about 50% mortality.
I understand you do electrofishing. What exactly is that?
So electrofishing is a method of attracting fish. So you put this big piece of equipment on your back. It's got a couple of batteries. And what you do is you get into the water with this wand, and this wand emits an electrical impulse, right? And so you put it in areas where you wouldn't normally be able to see fish in hopes of, you know, either counting them for a habitat assessment or a stock assessment, I mean, or if you're trying to, say, prevent them from getting trapped when the water level is lowered because of BC Hydro activities. So it emits an electrical impulse, and that attracts fish towards it, and you can bring those fish towards a net, for instance, scoop them up and either identify them or let them go to save them.
When you shock them, are they unconscious?
No, not really, no. It's pretty much as soon as you turn off the electrical impulse, they will spring back to life. It's not about knocking them unconscious, it's about bringing them towards the net. So they just kind of follow the electrical impulse. If you know what you're doing, you're not going to knock them unconscious or you're not going to kill them. There is you can kill them, and if you have an inexperienced electroshocker, they can do it, but we have methods to prevent that. We check, for instance, the turbidity of the water. The turbidity of the water is things like metals and particulates in the water, things that electricity can bounce off and create a higher electrical current. Same thing with temperature. All those things can impact it. But you have an experienced electrofisher out there, which everyone does. We always have a crew of four, one person being a supervisor. You have to do quite a bit better when you're doing a test to get the training for this, so they will monitor what you're doing.
Do you ever tag them?
No, we don't usually tag after electroshocking. That's done with different work.
What kind of work does that usually involve?
Typically you'll tag with a adult fish. So our project, I don't do this, but we do tag Chinook and coho species. I think they actually just tag Chinook and steelhead, and that's mostly just to monitor where they're going. But we also do this with sockeye, and what my project does is in the past we were tagging them, and that has to do with the burst swimming that we were talking about before, that had stuff like how fast they were moving, the temperatures they were in, and it also let you know location, right? We do that still now, but mostly we're just tagging for location purposes. That's what a tag does. It lets you know where they are, but you know, other tags can let you know other things too. Temperatures, how fast they're moving, stuff like that.
What are some of your other concerns for the fish in the future?
I mean, I think a big concern that people have right now is that every year it seems to be a low amount of snow. And that low snowpack is obviously going to mean high river temperatures and a low level of water. When you have high temperatures and a low level of water, you create horrible conditions for fish. It's not just in the river, in the Fraser. It goes all the way towards where they're spawning, right? Because you got to think, a spawning ground is fairly shallow. Like, fish like to spawn in shallow waters with small gravel. And so you have this hot, slow-moving water, and so their eggs aren't doing great. And then you go into, say, like, the river, where they're not doing great either. I mean, it's, on average lately, it seems to have been around 17 degrees over the course of the summer, and fish start to get stressed out at 17 degrees. And so there's just a lot of impacts that they have to deal with. They're dealing with the high temperature, and then they're dealing with things like industry, you know, people fishing them, just things like that. So, I mean, the outlook for sockeye right now is not great. Sockeye are a very temperamental fish. They spawn in only certain areas. All kinds of things impact them. You know, smell, dilution of water, all these things will impact how they move. And then you've got other things happening too right now. Like, you have species like, say, pink salmon that are doing great. So you have these pink salmon that are spawning in the same grounds that sockeye are, but they're doing so much better than sockeye. They're more adaptable. The result is going to be other species taking over where sockeye might have been. Species that are more adaptable that maybe we don't place as much value on. Like the pink salmon. So, I mean, ultimately, there's nothing we can do. If we need the water temperatures to be not so hot. We need people to change their methods of fishing, and we need organizations like DFO to be better supported by the British Columbia government so that when they're doing their predictions about how many fish are actually going to be coming up, it's a lot more precise, and the result is higher escapement numbers. Because right now they're not doing a very good job, and it's not really their fault they don't have enough money to do so.
So we need less fishing?
I don't think we need less fishing. I think we need more informed fishing. We need these governing agencies like DFO to be able to say, don't fish right now, fish later. The problem with predicting when people can fish is that you have runs that are not doing very good, that run at the same time in the Lower Fraser as runs that are doing great. And the result is that people go fish at that specific time. So for instance, right now we have a Gates Creek run, and that runs at the same time as I think the Adams River run. And the Adams River run historically does great. The problem being that you put a net in the water in the Lower Fraser, you don't know what the hell you're catching. It could be a Gates Creek sockeye. You don't know. It doesn't matter that the Gates Creek sockeye is doing horrible. That's what you're fishing. Now, DFO can test and see better times, but because they don't have enough money, their test fishery is like quite, it's not very substantial. It's actually a very small prediction. So we have this huge industry being monitored by people who don't have enough money to properly monitor it. And that's the big problem.
What is the most rewarding part of your job?
I mean, I think the most rewarding part of my job is just the people that I get to work with. I get to work with some really great people. I mean, in this industry, I've yet to met a person that I don't like. There's some really, really brilliant people that I get to work with who are incredibly passionate and who have dedicated their entire lives to this. So I think that's a really good part. I think just getting to be outside every day. I mean, I go to work and I get to go down to the river and I get to have fun with all these great people, and like my job is different every day. It's never the same thing. I don't go to a cubicle and sit down. I mean, one day I'll be out on the lake at like 4 o'clock in the morning with a trawl net behind me, and it's like storming out and crazy, and like I'm with like a crazy boat captain. And then the next day I'll be like on the river tagging, you know, sockeye salmon. So it's like, it's never the same.
What is a trawl net?
A trawl net. So a trawl net is just a net that goes behind a boat, and you just move the boat and the fish just kind of get swooped in there. The trawl net we use is massive. It's for catching juvenile sockeye. So it's just a crazy system. Like, it's huge. That was a pretty crazy night. I thought we were all going to die.
Do you see yourself the rest of your life working this line of work?
I think I'll work in the field for a small portion of my life. You can only work in the field for so long before you can't do it anymore, just because it's so physically demanding. I mean, I work probably 4 months straight. I don't get a day off. I don't want to get a day off either. And I think that's the hardest thing. And I think it's a pretty common situation. You move up, you stop being the person who's tagging the fish, and you start being the person who's organizing people tag the fish, I guess is how I would describe it. So I see myself for the next while, you know, until I'm older, doing this, but eventually I'll have to change into more of a management side, just because it won't be possible.
All right, thank you, Jesse, so much for this interview.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.
In this episode of Old Planet, Young People, you heard the voices of
Amanda Ned,
Lena Aziz,
Together, and then
Bonnie Adolph Dunn,
and
Jessica Hopkins.
Our theme music is Why by Classified. In this episode, you also heard part of Coming Up and Money or Love, both from the artist Socrates. All these tracks are instrumental versions from Canadian hip-hop artists. My name is Fraser Adolph, and I recorded, edited, and produced this episode. Old Planet, Young People is produced with technical assistance from radio station CHLS-FM in Lillooet, British Columbia. This series is made possible by generous funding from the Community Radio Fund of Canada and is part of their Youth On Air program.